For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for a brand new season of This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neve Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Welcome back from your summer break.
Hey.
It's good to be back.
Good to be back.
School's back in session. Last week, Oklahomans decided who they wanted as their candidates in the general election this November. In the Republican race for governor, Tulsa businessman Kevin Stitt defeated former Oklahoma City Mayor Mick Cornett with nearly 55% of the vote. Stitt now faces former Democratic Attorney General Drew Edmondson and Libertarian Chris Powell. Neva, were you surprised by the results of Tuesday's runoff?
Well, I think it was a very competitive runoff, hard swinging, as most of the runoffs were up and down the ballot. But when you look at it, Kevin Stitt had a very commanding win. I mean, with 68 counties and a campaign that cost $6.5 million and almost pushing $4 million of that his own money. So I think we had the contrast between the outsider and Mick Cornett, who had been the Oklahoma City mayor, did very well again in the metropolitan Oklahoma City area with the counties that he won, Oklahoma, Cleveland, Canadian. As was the case when he lost a runoff in the congressional race some years ago, I mean, it became a contrast, I think, in some measure among Republican voters on the conservative issues that they care about. And on that, I think we saw that Kevin Stitt was able to capitalize on that and basically run the table across the state in terms of county wins.
Right.
Well, before we took a break, one of the things that we were talking about was who was going to pick up those Lamb voters. And if you look at the map, Cornett didn't do anything to expand his base. The counties that he won are almost, you know, identical to the counties that he won in the primary ballot way back in June. And so he did nothing to expand. And in the counties that he did win, he just didn't win big enough. I mean, he did win big in Oklahoma County, but he didn't win big enough. He won in Cleveland County, but not nearly as much. And so when you see Stitt taking over a lot of those Lamb voters, you know, Lamb country in rural Oklahoma in particular, you know, that's where Stitt won this race. And he created a lead that was just frankly insurmountable for Cornett to come out with. And I think that Neva's right. The outsider, the non-political actor, the Trump message, I mean, this really became a referendum on Donald Trump. And, you know, for those of us that have, you know, seen and worked around Mick Cornett as mayor for the last several years, last many years here in Oklahoma City, his efforts to try to position himself as a Trumpian candidate were just, you know, very disingenuous. I mean, it just didn't fit with who he was as a mayor. And I think that, you know, most Oklahomans recognize that. And, you know, he tried to pivot with the Bull Stitt commercials. And, you know, I initially didn't think that they were great, but whenever I would go visit relatives, they thought that they were wonderful, but they were not voting in that Republican primary either.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that, you know, Cornett didn't do himself any favors by trying to pivot rather than having a conversation about that. But with that runoff electorate, I think it was Stitt's to lose.
Somebody did ask, was it the Bull Stitt commercial? Do you think that might have been a backlash?
Well, I think that there could be some backlash off of that. In his attempt, as Ryan says, to pivot off of the immigration question and to pivot off of the loyalty to the president, whether, you know, what his real alignment was with President Trump. I mean, those things became major issues among the Republican runoff voters that came out. And we have to remember that when you have a drop-off in the runoff voting, I mean, the folks that come out on either side are those that are the most ideologically partisan, typically, in a race. And so those issues were core issues to them. They were values issues. They were partisan issues that they wanted to see really where the two candidates lined up. And I think that's where, in some measure, the Bull Stitt attempt to kind of deflect that may have in rural Oklahoma in particular may have somewhat backfired.
And folks wanted an answer. They wanted answers on those questions. And the answers that Cornett could honestly give weren't going to satisfy that runoff electorate in the Republican runoff. I mean, these are voters that have more confidence in the president than the senior aides to the president have in their own boss. And, you know, whether you like that or not, that's the Republican runoff makeup. And it was just not one that Cornett was going to walk into and have a lot of favorability. I think that dynamic, it's going to be very interesting, you know, moving into November, that outsider Trump candidate dynamic versus Drew Edmondson, who, you know, I think a lot of folks had hoped that he would run against Stitt. They saw Stitt as the more vulnerable of the two Republican candidates. I think that that's the wrong assessment. I think that I think Stitt has the potential to nationalize this race in a way that's problematic for Edmondson. Edmondson's key here is going to make this a referendum on the Republican legislature and on Mary Fallon and not on Donald Trump.
And I think that will be interesting because I think it's going to be very difficult not to nationalize this election and for the voters in Oklahoma to respond in kind.
Possibly the biggest surprise from Tuesday was the defeat of six incumbent Republicans in the state House. One Tulsa World op-ed says it was unprecedented to see so many incumbents lose. This included some big names from GOP representatives, including George Fott, Mike Ritz, Bobby Cleveland. The other thing in common, all six voted against the tax increase for teacher pay raises in the spring. Ryan, does this show the education walkout had an impact?
I think absolutely it does. And, you know, all politics are local. You know, every one of these races, I'm sure that, you know, folks in those local jurisdictions can point, or in those local districts can point to particular things about those candidates as to why they won or lost. But educators should and are taking a victory lap here because there's really not any other issue that transcends all of these campaigns, that ties them all together and makes every one of these candidates that lost identical in some way. And that was their lack of support for education during the last session and multiple special sessions that were, you know, both continuous for like the last almost 2 years. And so I think that if you're an educator in Oklahoma right now, you recognize that in that electorate, you had a huge impact. And that's where I think that there's this subtext to the Republican primary runoff electorate that I said, you know, they trust the president more than his own senior aides. But in these, at the state level, whenever you can nationalize this and make it a Trump versus the Democrat race, I think that that's problematic. At these local levels, they weren't able to do that. And that's not what happened. And these voters, even Republican primary runoff voters, they cared about education, and that's what they voted on.
Neva.
I think it's true that that was the backdrop, kind of the overarching takeaway that people will see with these six incumbents losing their reelection bid. But I think that the bigger point to be made is in each of those cases, they were already embattled, and they were embattled in various ways in their respective districts. It wasn't a case of where across the board that was the only issue being addressed. It was the issue being hammered, and I think you had different issues, and that just kind of added, you know, I guess in some measure people would say icing on the cake, but it still took it took in low turnout elections in every one of those cases. I mean, in some cases those were still very close elections, mm-hmm. and you know, so it wasn't just being galvanized by the one issue of the vote on House Bill 1010, but that was certainly the catalyst to bring some outside independent expenditures in that I think we saw in all of those races, where they saw the opportunity to weigh in and make their point as well. And so I think we see the impact of that outside money coming into some of these races. It wasn't exclusively the reason either, but I think the composite effect was we had the perfect storm. We knew that this was a very volatile year. I think Republicans across the board, the wake-up call is that you don't take anything for granted, certainly not in a primary or runoff, and no one should take anything for granted in a general. I mean, you know, these campaigns are not foregone conclusions. When you underestimate the power of the voter at the local level, sometimes you come up short.
And I think a lot of these elected officials who lost kind of felt that way. They were kind of invulnerable. They could do anything they wanted, and they were not going to lose come the election time.
I mean, I think that's certainly the longer you're in and the fewer competitive races that you have, that sense of invulnerability, I think, creeps up on you.
And I do think you also had an element that's kind of the inside baseball element, in that with some of these incumbents, there was the infighting among Republicans in their own caucus, mm-hmm. on the issue of 1010, on other issues. And that somewhat was a subliminal factor, I think, in all of this. You didn't have the united front. You didn't have everyone going to the, you know, in concerted effort to go to the wall to make sure that incumbents came back. Some of them were on their own out there, and it became a very lonely place with an avalanche of attack coming from multiple sides. And I think for some of them, it was something they weren't familiar with and hadn't really dealt with before. Some of these folks had had fairly easy elections from the get-go.
From the very beginning.
From the very beginning, and now you have them in the firefight of their life, and they were not, you know, not positioned to do well in the end.
And whenever you've got these really close elections like this, and, you know, you, Neva, you talked about the outside money coming in. You've got internal organizing, OEA leadership, Oklahoma Education Association leadership in those districts, knocking doors, and in races, especially where you have incumbents that aren't familiar or aren't their door knocking muscles haven't been exercised in many cycles. If you've got a handful of motivated educators out there on the doorsteps, it may take 10 or 12 votes to get, or 10 or 12 voters out there knocking doors to get the 100 votes that some of these folks lost by.
And one thing you have in common in every district has a school.
I mean, you look at even Sean Roberts surviving by 87 votes. 87. I mean, and you could make arguments of, you know, what was the difference in whether he won or lost. I mean, some, you know, there's some that would say that, frankly, the James Lankford endorsement at the end was a significant factor. There are always those things that happen, and yet there were other races where, you know, folks came in and endorsed, and the incumbent didn't survive the challenge. So I think it's all across the board, but it's certainly a wake-up call, I think, to lawmakers on either side of the aisle. When you get into this kind of a political environment, you better be positioned to take it on very strongly yourself.
And for those of us who covered, much more exciting election cycle than we are used to.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Another exciting thing, in the race for attorney general, it's not the results which were surprising, but the margin of victory. Incumbent Republican Mike Hunter defeated challenger Gettner Drummond by just 271 votes. However, Drummond, who put up such a fight for nearly 6 months, refused to seek a recount. Neva, why would Drummond concede this race so easily?
Well, I think easily probably is not the right phrase, but certainly after a long, very hard-fought, bitter battle between these two warriors, I think when you look at the 271 number and you think about a recount or looking at irregularities or your options, I think what his team explored was, you know, kind of all of those situations, and determined that that there was not going to be the threshold there. They were not going to be successful in overturning that number, and felt that you know, as he said, that it just prolonged it kind of prolonged things unnecessarily. And so I think, frankly, you know, from the Republican perspective, I think people applaud Gettner Drummond for you know, for being very gracious and being very quick to call an end to that conversation and move forward. I mean, the unity clearly was articulated by both Attorney General Hunter as well as Mr. Drummond, and I think now for Republicans, they see this as move forward with the fall election still ahead, and make sure that you know, that business is finished. You know, when you look at that total, to me the takeaway is four votes per county would have changed the outcome of the election. Yeah. So when people say, you know, and I talk about it all the time, and I know Ryan does as well, when people say their vote doesn't matter, that it's, you know, everybody assumes what the outcome's going to be, this is a perfect illustration in a statewide race of how significant each person's vote really was in that election.
Sure, Ryan.
Yeah, quite incredible result. You know, that was, you know, everybody sitting there watching the precincts rolling in, and you're waiting on that last precinct. And then we all knew provisional ballots were still out. You know, Gettner conceded before the provisional ballots had been counted, I believe. And, you know, there was a statistical it was statistically improbable.
Yeah, the 271 was the final.
He could have technically won after they, but, you know, they were outstanding provisional ballots in Oklahoma County, where Mike Hunter had a huge lead. So it was unlikely that the votes were going to be there to get him back. I think Drummond lives to fight another day. And, you know, that's, you know, if he had fought this, it would have been incredibly expensive. It would have been a very drawn out process. We're talking about a statewide recount. We're talking about, you know, looking at irregularities in 77 counties. Yeah. This is expensive and takes, you know, maybe, you know, a month, 2 months to complete. And in the meantime, you've got a Democratic candidate out there running for attorney general that I think most folks think is an underdog. But if you've got the Republicans mired in a 2 month, $1 million plus recount, who knows? Anything can happen. And so I think that Drummond looked at that and said, even assuming that there is a path forward here with a recount, I've got a much better path forward as a potential candidate for something else in the future.
And he certainly left that door wide open by not saying, you know, either way. And as one would expect, I think, in the very short time after the results.
And technically, in 8 years, there will be that seat will be open because of term limits.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and he could always challenge Hunter again.
Yeah.
You know, he could run for any number of things. The amount of money that he spent to buy name recognition in the state of Oklahoma. And right now, everybody's got this bad taste in their mouth because that campaign was so negative and so bitter. But people will forget. The one thing that will be familiar to them at some point in the future, whenever he does decide to run again, and I think that that's more likely than not, is they're going to remember Drummond. They're going to remember Gettner Drummond. They may not remember what he ran for, but they're going to remember that name. And that's an enormous foundation to start any campaign on, especially a statewide
And Republicans
campaign.
Will remember his loyalty to the party in basically saying, bowing out.
Absolutely. There is definitely value in that.
Yeah, he bought himself a lot of goodwill by walking away from that recount.
Any other surprises that you guys had for the runoffs? Was there anything else that kind of drew your attention?
Well, you know, I think that you saw a kind of a runaway up in Tulsa County with Steve Kunstweiler for the DA running there. And that just, I think demonstrates the power of incumbency and how, but that was not when I say it was a runaway, it wasn't as close, I think, as a lot of folks wanted it to be. But at the same time, you had a conversation there about criminal justice reform issues that really hadn't happened in the context of a DA's race. And I think we're going to see more and more of those conversations happening in general elections throughout the rest of this campaign cycle. Mm-hmm. Here in Oklahoma County, Carrie Blumenthal moving forward with the county commissioner race over former state representative and former state senator Al McCaffrey, and Kendra Horn just crushing Tom Guild in that primary there, now moving forward to face Steve Russell in the 5th District race for Congress.
Well, yeah, I think one of the things I'd like to point out is the fact that when we look at the legislative makeup and what the change, how dramatic it already is, not even taking into account what will still happen in the November general election, is that we have 52 new faces at a minimum that are going to be coming in. I mean, and the breakdown of that, obviously it's 40 Republicans and 12 Democrats, but when you look at how that came about, I mean, we've had 12 defeated, we had 18 term limited. Mm-hmm. 19 chose not to seek re-election. We had one death during the campaign cycle, right. And then we did have two. Making the decision to move from a House race to a Senate race, but that total landscape, as we look at it, really points to the fact that from a leadership standpoint and from a legislative standpoint, looking at session next year, I mean, it's going to be a very interesting time with the backdrop of not a looming deep budget hole, but rather a surplus. I mean, the coffers are going to look much different for the folks coming in, not only as freshmen, but returning lawmakers, and I think it's going to make for a fascinating setup.
And representation of women, across the board. In my ballot in Oklahoma County, I had women on the ballot for county, state, and federal races, and I voted for the female candidate in each one of those, and each one of them won. And, you know, that's, I think that we're seeing, many more women candidates out there, both on the ballot, but on the doorsteps and winning these races, and that's really exciting.
The past few months have certainly been interesting in the realm of medical marijuana. Since it passed in June, the health department made rules regarding the product, got sued over the rules and reprimanded, passed new rules, and now lawmakers are considering their own legislation to deal with this issue. Meanwhile, the first medical marijuana licenses were issued. Ryan, what are your thoughts? Where are we now?
How long do we have?
Well, we'll be tomorrow.
We've only been gone 10 weeks, Ryan. So give us a quick recap.
Yeah. So let's sum up 10 weeks in a couple of minutes here. You know, I think that one of the best things that could have happened for medical marijuana advocates in the state of Oklahoma when this happened, of course, everybody was losing their mind, myself included, when the health department passed these rules that required things like pharmacists to be in dispensaries, that limited cannabis products to non-smokable, did all of these things were totally contrary to State Question 788. People lost their mind. Again, myself included in those folks, and looking at litigation options, ways to ensure that the will of the people of Oklahoma moved forward. And, you know, everybody from the ACLU to the Attorney General Mike Hunter are out there chastising the health department over this. And of course, then we have the implosion within. And, you know, that's another topic I'm sure we can talk about in another time. But, you know, in retrospect, you know, the health department walked away from that. And I think that and I say that that's probably the best thing that could have happened right now, because what it did was that it sent a signal to both regulators, administrators, but I think more importantly to state lawmakers, that the people of Oklahoma, they passed this, they meant it when they passed it, and they want their politicians to protect it. And so the backlash that immediately happened after those initial rules, I think was a really, it was a real firewall to protect State Question 788 moving forward. We've seen a working group of legislators, a bipartisan group that have been meeting, asking very thoughtful questions and looking at ways that they need to address this, potentially in a special session, although I think that's unlikely, right, but more likely in the regular session coming up in 2019. But again, you know, I think that the voters and the backlash over that initial health department action have created a firewall. And so any sort of regulations that we see, I think are going to be minimal, and they're not really going to have a huge impact on patients' access to medical cannabis in Oklahoma.
And how does the ruling party, the Republicans have mostly usually been against any kind of marijuana legislation, how do they deal with this going in, knowing that the voters really want something on that works for them?
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, some of the polling clearly indicates that the voters understood what they were voting for, that they understood it was medical marijuana. They voted with that understanding as they went to the polls. And I think that set the stage for what's going on, as Ryan describes. I think there is a clear effort being made to be transparent, to be to allow all parties from all, you know, every persuasion and point of view to have input, be at the table, and have an open process that ultimately will come about with something that will give us a framework for a successful move forward. And I don't think there's anyone virtually out there that chooses to be a detractor to that, you know, to that proposition. I think we understand and recognize that that the people spoke, that the state question was was laid out, and 880,000 Oklahomans went to the polls, and their wishes were expressed. And now I think the lawmakers, I think, will use that as the impetus to come in and be very direct in how they approach this, and hopefully in a very bipartisan way, just as the committee that you described has been trying to do it in recent weeks. I mean, there's no point in trying to score cheap political shots on this. The bigger overarching issue is, let's get it in a place where we know how it's going to operate. We know what the rules are. There's the enforcement element where there needs to be, and move forward. And then I think all parties can walk away and be happy about how Oklahoma's approached this.
Yeah, it's really a model in bipartisan operation. I mean, there really haven't been many other issues at the Capitol that, you know, folks have just really coalesced around. And I think, you know, I commend Republican leadership, because I think that whether it's just political expediency or they really understand and have moved on this idea of the medical benefits of marijuana.
And I think that is the key. It's the medical benefits. We're not talking about full-blown legalization of marijuana. We're talking about the issue of medical marijuana. And again, I think some of the polling that I saw both before and after the election clearly indicated that voters understood the difference and understood what they were voting for, because if you ask a follow-up question about full-blown legalization, you got a different result.
Right.
And so I think they knew what they were voting on. Most every Oklahoman and American nowadays recognizes what people deal with, in terms of cancer and all of the other things that were these medical things like medical marijuana make a tremendous difference in being able to be able to make their lives a little more comfortable and better.
And as we mentioned earlier, more than 50 new faces, regardless, are coming into the Capitol.
Yeah.
Do you think that'll help them? Maybe, okay, we can work together, because it's going to be 50 new people.
I mean, if you talk to folks like David Boren, or if you listen to the words of folks like the late Senator John McCain, you know, one of the things that they tell you that was instrumental to their ability to work across the aisle was that they had opportunities to work together. you know, they had opportunities to familiarize themselves with their colleagues in a non-combative way. And so to the extent that Republicans and Democrats are sitting together on this joint working group and they're working together and they're not, you know, thinking about scoring points on one another, but really working towards a thoughtful and meaningful and effective regulatory and legislative response to State Question 788, I think that, you know, there's only really good that can come out. I mean, I'm not naive to think that it's going to, you know, lead to everybody, you know, holding hands through a field of daisies tomorrow. But I mean, but we can hope.
But the inauguration of a new governor in January, the new legislature coming in and being sworn in November after the general election, I mean, does set the stage for kind of a restart. I mean, we've been through some tough times from a legislative perspective and a governing perspective, and I think Republicans will be in a unique place and have an opportunity now to really kind of reset the stage and cast the cast a vision, you know, from the legislative perspective of what they want to see moving forward. And it'll be a great opportunity with a lot of new folks infused into the process, but also with returning folks that have some, you know, some better understanding of how that process works to be able to make it happen.
And we're already seeing on the people side of this, on the patient side of this, you know, clinics opening up, businesses forming, real estate booms in areas around the state of Oklahoma. And I think one of the most important things that it's going to happen is the lowering of stigma among marijuana use. You know, we're going to start to see doctors, lawyers, teachers, you know, the idea, the caricature of who uses marijuana, I think, is going to begin to slip away. And we're going to, hopefully that will have an effect on the way that we look at our other drug laws in the state of Oklahoma.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.